That was an amazing introduction. Thank you, Stacey. And I want to start by thanking all the organizers, and especially those, Tynan and others, who invited both of us to speak, because I think it reflects the highly evolved nature of your movements, that you recognize that it's not only people whose names have been in the news that need to be heard from, and that we are nothing without one another. And so, you know, it's not just the nostalgia for the 60s that we have to get rid of. It's also the looking to someone else other than yourself and your friends to tell you what is up and what to do. So this is unusual. We've never done this quite this way before. And I wanted to say, we went to the Anarchist Book Fair today, and we were just blown away by it. It was wonderful. And for me, it was, I don't know, I was almost going to cry, because I felt like, okay, so this is the regeneration of struggle, especially around Palestine, to see the number of banners and people organizing solidarity with Palestine. In my day, there were 5 of us or 10 of us standing against the Israel Day parade, and there are more now. So that's a very, very important thing. So, and then to see that there were people organizing against police killings, and to see, we brought a T-shirt with Anas Benis on it and the other people who've been killed by the cops, to see people that, what struck me about the book fair was that it wasn't a lot of people saying, you know, here's my line, here's my organization, you have to agree with me, you know, we are doing, it was more about, let's do the work, and that was very exciting. So when I was sitting having coffee this morning, I realized that it's precisely 40 years since I realized that I was a revolutionary, or decided that I was a revolutionary. And one thing, we're going to talk as briefly as we can, which we're both kind of chatterboxes, so that's not very helpful. But, oh, yeah, right, it's just me. So, because we want to do question and answer, because this is definitely better as a dialogue. So I'm just going to say a few things about those years, and then later on we can talk about it. And what I was thinking this morning is that what happened to me, well, the main thing that happened to me personally was the Black Panther Party and Fred Hampton in particular. But the way that was important was that I had been really hurt all my life, you know, hurting about the inequalities I saw and racism and just not happy because of it and, you know, longing for some kind of justice. But everything to me was a single issue. You know, there was this terrible thing and that terrible thing. And we just had to sort of hope that each thing would get better, or that somehow things would improve, or that white people would stop being racist. And what happened in the 60s to me and to thousands of other people, and this is what characterized the Weather Underground, is that we began to see that there was a strategy to change things, not just incrementally, but that there was a strategy in the world that was attacking the source of most, not every single problem, but the system that created the context in which every single problem existed, and that was U.S. imperialism. And because we were in the United States, there were internal colonies of people, black people in particular in those days were the most revolutionary, you know, active, but there were also Native Americans and Puerto Ricans who were struggling for their right to independence and for their right to self-determination. And so that unites all the things that we were doing. And I kind of think, you know, I don't have a sense, and first of all, I should also say, we're from the United States, so the situation is different. So we can say things about the movement in the United States that are not going to be the same for you all. And, you know, we're also going to try not to make, you know, oh, Canada is so perfect and you're almost socialist, you know. But the United States really sucks big time. And it's an interesting place to be because of that. So So we identified what we thought was the main place where struggle was happening, and we didn't have to do it by ourselves because Che Guevara had said it. Create 2-3 many Vietnams was a strategy. And we thought within the mother country, within the belly of the beast, we could function in such a way that would help to sort of destroy imperialism. And the reason that we engaged in armed struggle in those days was because there was revolution going on around the world. And people, oppressed peoples were using people's war. You never hear about that anymore. Organized into people's war, which was not just about armed struggle, but it did use guerrilla warfare and armed struggle to defeat colonialist powers. And that was what was true about Vietnam. So it wasn't just that things were so bad, it was also that things were so exciting and possible. And I don't know what that means for today. I mean, I have a lot of questions about it, but one thing I've been thinking about recently is that in a lot of the Palestinian support work that happens in the United States, we focus a lot on the crimes of Israel, which is fine, we should, but we miss, and we talk about, you know, we sort of say, yeah, and America, United States of America, not America, United States is the, you know, is the stronghold of Zionism. But what we have, and what I haven't seen enough, and maybe I just haven't seen it, is an analysis of the role that Israel and the United States together are playing in the world, in the entire world spectrum, from the seat of the Middle East, and that that affects things that are going on in the rest of the world. And I just think that there's that also that global context, as well as supporting the right of self-determination. And one thing I think is interesting, which I don't know is happening up here or not, is that when I got out of prison, there were three positions that were current. There was Zionism, duh, and there was anti-Zionism, which was small, and then there was anti-occupation. And I used to, you know, and I had friends who were anti-occupation, and I was sort of nervous to really challenge, because I thought, great, they're part of these demonstrations and stuff. I was nervous to challenge and push on the issue of anti-Zionism, but when I would talk with people, I would say, to me, there is no such thing as three positions. There are two positions, because as long as Israel exists on the basis of Zionism, there will never be a democracy. There will never be a solution. And I think that that's more and more taking form. I'm not really sure of that, but that would be a question I would want to talk about. Okay, so I just want to say one more thing, and then I'm going to pass it over to this very funny person over here, which is that one thing that I think, a couple of errors that I think we made in that era. One is that militancy is a tactic, and it should come from the politics of the occasion. So our militancy came a lot from the fact that we were supporting black people who were fighting back, you know, and that was going on. It didn't come, when it became a problem was when people looked at what we had done and said, oh, militancy is good. So in any situation, we have to figure out, how do we break a window? How do we, you know, how do we heighten things? And I'll tell this one little story that for me encapsulated it. We were in Miami in 72, I guess, at one of the party conventions. I think it was the Republicans. And the entire convention center was utterly off limits. There were buses parked end to end. So all of our plans to march on the convention center, and all our plans were impossible. And we ended up sort of confronting some delegates, and then we went to get a sandwich. I mean, it was sort of like we thought, well, we'll regroup and try to have like a protest tomorrow. And we were walking through Miami, and these two white guys were, when we had done this to the delegates' cars, we had taken those things that you let the air out of tires, and we had let the air out of their tires. Right outside, the delegates, okay? That was who we were targeting. So we're walking along, and these two white guys are doing the same thing to a car that was stopped at a stoplight. And in the car was this elderly black couple. And the woman was driving, and the man was sitting, he looked so tired, and he was, you know, you could see his shirt was soaked with sweat, and the collar was open, and the little fake tie was, you know, she had picked him up from work. And these kids are letting the air out of the tire. So I ran up, and I said, stop, what are you doing? And this guy turns on me and says, don't you believe in militancy? Well, I don't believe in militancy. I believe, you know, you should use what tactics you need at the time. But it's not a principle. And I think that was something that was taken from us that was incorrect, because tactics have to respond to the political situation that you're in. And on the other hand, I would say that we should never allow the state to define which of our tactics are permissible and which are not. And that for me is kind of a principle. All right, funny lady. And if you make fun of me one more time, go on.
Everything Laura said, I agree with. Okay, I'm done. No. First, I want to apologize not only for my bad French, but my bad English. Because coming from the United States, I know very little about Canada, and I am struck with how much you all know about us. And so if I make a mistake about when I talk about saying this country...
Is your mic on?
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. When I say this country, you know my subconscious has imperialized you. And I assume you're our 51st state. So for any possible slippages, I'm sorry. Basically, I share 98% of Laura's politics. I don't come from her background. I come from the Midwest. I'm sort of an intuitive anti-capitalist by virtue of my crummy family and how hard my dad had to work and how mean he was because of it. And I wasn't really that interested in politics. I wanted to escape my family, and to do that, I got into the drama department. So I guess in the 70s, I came out as a lesbian, and then I broke up big time. And after that, I sort of discovered that there were organizations out there, like Women Against Rape, Women Against Military Madness, Women's Braille Press, that I joined, Women Against Women at times. But I've always had sort of an ad hoc approach. I've never really been part of the hardcore, serious, organized left, in part because it just didn't exist in the Midwest the same way it did when Laura was growing up in New York. So I come from a whole different background. So I think I've always felt that, like Laura, that intuitively that things are wrong, that our country has assumed that we are the only human beings in the world and everybody else is there to exploit in different ways. But in terms of dealing with it, I have marched and signed petitions and done the activist things. I'm totally frustrated still with what works and what doesn't. I just don't know. You know, occasionally a well-placed kaboom might, but usually, I don't know. So what personally I do is turn to, I guess, a little back to the theater. I wouldn't call this art, but, you know, it is what I do. And here's one of my recent columns, sort of an abbreviated version. I've done a series of sort of monologues of who I call the mad activist. Because I think you do have to be a little crazy in order to feel everything that's going on, you know, what's in terms of what's wrong politically. Oof. And try to hold it all together, and a human being usually can't. You just fray in interesting ways, and here's possibly one of them. This is called the Mad Activist's Declaration of Codependence. The sages of history say, know thyself, and I do. I used to be a peace activist, but thanks to the sages of pop psychology, I see now that I am a codependent. Yet, I refuse to be your ordinary run-of-the-mill codependent who's stuck in a crappy relationship with just one needy, dependent, abusive individual. I say nyet to that. I'm not the, oh, my man, I love him so, wifey, whose husband beats her senseless, steals her credit cards to pay off his gambling debts, kicks her cat through a window, then goes out on a drunken binge and murders 9 people. I'm not the girl who quits her job, forgets her dreams, and spends the rest of her life setting up legal defense teams, praying that one day her precious dickwad will walk out of prison, because really, wasn't the whole thing her fault? If I give up the best years of my life, it's not going to be to enable this destructive behavior of one measly alcoholic. It's going to be for an entire government, see? As an activist turned codependent, my purpose in life is to enable the destructive behavior of the United States of America. So, even though
America steals my money to pay off gambling debts, beats me senseless, kicks my cat through the window, then goes out on drunken power binges, bombing people, poisoning the planet, and annihilating whole civilizations. I know that deep down, America really loves me. Oh, sure, I stay home a lot, weeping into my pillow. But then I remember that America hurts too. America may seem needy and demanding, but secretly, America is afraid I will go over to some other superpower. That's why America searches my bag and taps my phone. America is jealous. It's kind of cute. America, love him or leave him. From time to time, I panic and revert to my naive 60s mode of communication. I go out on anti-war rallies. I write letters asking why America has hurt so many people so bad. But America tells me to shut up. America tells me this is all for my own good, so I shut up, because if I do, I'll lose this relationship. And really, there's nothing I can do to stop America, is there? This is called having low self-esteem. However, as an American codependent, I can have low self-esteem and be proud. Actually, if you think about it, thinking you don't count for much is kind of patriotic. I mean, what does your life matter when you're poor and 19 and shooting it out in Iraq, defending democracy against those mentally ill suicide bombers? In fact, I think most of the U.S. military is probably even more codependent about America than I am. Bless their needy little hearts. But in the big picture, I know that I am serving history, which is chock full of brave codependentistas who gave up happiness or careers to enable some truly depraved people. Some of them, such as Jesus, Superman, and Ava Brown, I have put on my screensaver. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking America is addicted to oil, that someday soon they're going to cut off the main line and kick America out of rehab. Then America and I will die together in the gutter. But I don't care. I don't even care if one night America comes home from one of its drunken binges and murders me. Codependents don't ask for much. We give. I have given my house, my job, my kids, my health, my air to America. But it's okay. It's okay, see, because I am part of history.
Is that all you want to say?
That's all I wrote.
Okay. So you can imagine what kind of letters she wrote to me while I was in prison. And they were very funny. Okay, so now we're supposed to talk about the era in which we met, but also about my case a little more. And Ashley told you some about the case. So let me just be really clear about this. So I did join the Weather Underground, and I was in the Weather Underground pretty much I was in Weatherman first, which was part of SDS. I was never actually in SDS. I was in advanced placement for revolutionaries. I went right to sleeping on the floor in a house with, like, you know, 10 people in 9 sleeping bags. And our slogan in those days was "Bring the War Home." And what informed our that slogan was that we felt that the United States makes war all around the world, and then everyone in the United States who's white, or, you know, some people of color who are upper class, but very few, gets to live a very nice, peaceful life. But if you're black, or if you're Puerto Rican, or if you're Native American, or if you're in one of the places in the world that the United States is making war, either declared or undeclared, or supporting a regime that chokes the life out of people, then you don't get to live in peace. So how come you should get to live in peace when you're a legislator in Washington, D.C.? So that was our point, was that was the point of the kabooms. And we never thought that we were going to change policy that way. I mean, that's how the government defined it. And I'm asked all the time, do you think your bombings made a difference? And it's like, I have no idea. What makes a difference? You do it because, A, you have to, because you just don't feel happy in this kind of society if you are not acting to change things. And B, you hope the things that you do make a difference. You go out on a picket line, you do a picket line. We did a picket line in Boston in the 70s while I was in Weatherman, but I was above ground. I was doing above ground work. And this organization called ROAR, Restore Our Alienated Rights, which was like the Klan, had two members out of the four education, what was it, what do you call it, Board of Education members. Two of them were members of ROAR, and it was during the busing, the anti-busing struggle, when black children were being bused to white schools to integrate the schools in Boston, and the kids were being attacked, and there was a race war going on. But it wasn't a war. It was a one-sided war, because it was against black people, and it was totally white supremacist. So we started a picket in front of the school committee, and I guess it was called the school committee. Anyway, we went the first week, and there were like five of us, and there were all these construction workers, white construction workers, threatening us, and we were scared. And we stayed for that hour, and we did. Anyway, the end of the story is that by the end of a year of this, we had like 150 people on this picket line every week, and it really made a difference, and we had no idea that that was going to happen. So it's sort of an act of faith. Being an activist is an act of faith, that you're going to touch people somehow. And that was why we did bombings. It was mostly to make that point. And we tried to choose good targets. So I was in the Weather Underground, and then the Weather Underground actually ended, and you wouldn't know this from seeing the film, because the 70s, the 60s began it, but the 70s, the early 70s, were really a high tide of black nationalism, revolutionary black nationalism in the United States. And there was an armed component to that, because people were coming back from Vietnam and had been in the army and had learned not only how to use arms, but had seen what was going on in Vietnam, where oppressed people were using whatever they could get. It wasn't, you know, the B-52s. It was more the little guns that they had, you know, the leftovers that they got from the Soviet Union, et cetera, and homemade devices to fight. So there was a high tide of revolutionary nationalism, and the Weather Underground became more and more isolated from that by its own desire. And some of us objected to that, and there was a struggle within the organization, and the organization basically ended. And then later on, those of us who left the organization sort of went to the other extreme and worked solely under the leadership of the black liberation struggle and the Puerto Rican independence movement, to an extent that I think was problematic, but we could talk about that later. But we then began to do armed struggle again, because the revolutionary groups in both the black and the Puerto Rican struggle were engaging in armed struggle, and they were being attacked by the cops. They were being sought by the cops. And so, to sort of throw a red herring in the path, some of us started to do bombings. And the other one that I just want to mention is the Police Benevolent Association. And I know that here you have, what, the Brotherhood, which is at least a little bit more, isn't it? That's what, yeah, which is at least a little bit, sounds a little bit more thuggish. You know, the Police Benevolent Association in New York always comes out, and after the cops kill some 9-year-old kid, and say, oh, gee, that was a radio? We thought it was a gun. Well, we were justified in it. The PBA always gets up and says, yes, they were threatened, in a huge campaign. So, that's why we targeted them. So we never thought that we would never be arrested. I mean, we hoped and we tried, but we failed. So we got arrested and went to prison for 14 years. Well, I went to prison for 14 years. Other people did less, more time. We took a plea bargain because one of our co-defendants was very, very ill with cancer, Alan Berkman, and he is again fighting cancer now. But he did survive, and we took the plea bargain so that he could get out of D.C. General and D.C. Jail and to a federal prison that was near a decent cancer hospital. So what else am I supposed to say about my... I'll just say that the other thing that happened in prison was that when we were in the D.C. Jail, AIDS struck. And I remember sitting in my cell and reading the Washington Post, and that was, and there was a thing about how a man was claiming that he had gotten HIV. Well, I guess it was still calling it AIDS in those days, or it had just begun to be called HIV. He had gotten it from a prostitute. And well, that's who I was in prison with, sex workers. And I'm thinking, well, what happened to the woman? And there's nothing, who cared, you know? Women didn't get HIV. So the women around me were dying. So I and my co-defendants all started doing HIV work, and it's sort of in the name of all those friends of mine who died in those days before there were the drugs. Other people, probably some people are old enough to know what I'm talking about, that I went to PAS and am an editor there now. That's it.
Yes,
take it away.
Or take what away?
I don't know. Whatever you want.
Okay. All right. Well, not being the extemporaneous speaker that Lara is, I mean, she's really good, right?
Oh, shit.
I guess I wanted to talk about Lara's case. I moved to New York from the Midwest, and became a little more interested in what was going on in terms of the left, although I never believed that the revolution was going to happen next Tuesday, and evidently lots of people did back then.
It happened. You missed
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You forgot me. So I was very intrigued, in constant pain in many ways because of what our country was doing and getting more and more, knowledgeable about it. I remember when the United States invaded Grenada in 1983, one of the first things I did when I went to New York was go to this mammoth demonstration against it. It was wonderful. Little did I know, meanwhile, that someone else along with her cohorts were working on a different way to protest it. So one thing led to another, and I did end up doing an article about the women in Lara's case for Sojourner. It's an old feminist magazine that sort of went uterus up about 5 years ago. Like so many other good magazines, but I did a story on the women co-defendants, and later the whole all the co-defendants. And here's basically in a nutshell, and I do mean nutshell, an account of meeting Lara in prison. Here is a story of a highly strange Grill. For Grill is how she secretly thought of herself. It was other people who thought of her as highly strange. Anyway, this highly strange Grill, she fell in love with a prisoner. Anyone can tell you this is a bad idea. It gets worse. She fell in love with a lesbian prisoner, a lesbian political prisoner, a leftist lesbian political prisoner, who, along with two men and three other women, was facing over 70 years behind bars for a series of property bombings. Among them, the 1983 bombing of the Capitol building in protest of the U.S. invasion of Grenada. This highly strange, oh, what the fuck, it was me. I first heard about the case in 1988. The targets of the group were accused of bombing were, from the point of view of a 70s lesbian such as myself, fairly well chosen. They included the Police Benevolent Association, after the police shooting of African-American grandmother Eleanor Bumpers, and the apartheid-era South African consulate, as well as our friend the Capitol building. No one was killed or even slightly injured in the blasts. The Capitol's Republican cloakroom was damaged and Teddy Roosevelt's bust busted. Small injuries compared to the overthrow of a small country. The indicted prisoners, I noticed, were educated, middle-class, white people. What the hell were they thinking, I wondered. Didn't they know they were throwing away their lives? Wasn't taking up arms a tactical disaster, almost sure to hurt the innocent, while giving the government another incentive to upgrade its firepower? Yes, but given the delusion of democracy in this country, the United States, anything that broke the anesthetic grip of the 6 o'clock news was a relief. I agreed with them. I disagreed with them. I needed to know who they were. A newspaper wanted a story on the four women in the case. I read the attorney's briefs and political pamphlets. I studied the defendant's photos. They all seemed well-modulated, intelligent people, Yet because of their anti-government stance, they'd drawn inordinate sentences from previous charges. Then there was Laura Whitehorn, unconvicted, who at that point had spent more time in prison, almost 4 years without bail, than any prisoner in U.S. history. I looked at Laura's photo. She was wearing a keffiyeh, her fist in the air. She looks so bossy, I thought. I went to Washington, D.C. to interview the four women. The D.C. jail was noise and grime and a brutal hopelessness permeated by fluorescent lighting and the omnipresence of guards. The prisoners, 95% black, wore jumpsuits. One by one, Susan Rosenberg, then Marilyn Buck, then Linda Evans were brought into the glass-walled cubicle where I interviewed them. Then a small gray-haired woman with deep brown eyes was led in handcuffs, carrying a stack of legal papers. She grinned and offered me a roll of silence equals death stickers. As we talked, I was startled to find that I was quietly, perversely becoming happy. It was another day before I realized I had a large crush on Laura Whitehorn. I was euphoric and deeply shocked when the feeling became mutual. Soon, we realized we loved each other. Laura was finally sentenced, the maximum of 23 years, and transferred to the Lexington, Kentucky Women's Prison. So, for me, began the years of low-grade terror that comes with loving someone who is in constant danger. In prison, Laura, like her co-defendants, had almost relinquished the white skin privilege that allows most Caucasians to be treated as human beings. Like her black and Latina friends in the general prison population, she could be beaten up or put in the hole for various infractions. Like other political prisoners, Laura could at any time be confined to a sensory deprivation unit. She could die of bad medical care. Once, on a summer afternoon in the first year of our love, I fell asleep and dreamed that I was moving, flying through a blackness to reach someone I loved the most. Such lift, such hope, only to find myself face to face with a skull. Then there were our political fights. How could I be in this relationship without signing on as a revolutionary? Why did I criticize armed struggle? I would die for my principles, Laura said during one of our arguments. And I would die for my right to remain ambivalent, I retorted. We talked on the phone, but only when Laura called me. It's impossible to call a prisoner. We visited, but only when I had the money to go to Kentucky, later California. I must have seemed to her cloying and demanding, always wanting to talk about feelings. Our conversations were suffused with misunderstanding, longing, and anger. Always they were monitored by guards or agents. I hated myself for being codependent enough to love a prisoner. I wondered if I was crazy. Friends and therapists told me in one way or another, this hurts too much, she's using you, let her go. She would want you to be happy. Laura herself told me to see other people, but how could I when I loved her so much? I must have acted weird and jerky. I must have treated friends badly. Certainly, I lost friends. Finally, you knew it was coming, right? Laura and I did the simple, sensible thing. We broke up. We went on with our lives. But you know what? Stupidly, masochistically, wonderfully, we got back together. And on August 6th, 1999, after 14 years and 3 months of incarceration, Laura Jane Whitehorn, having served her time, walked out of prison. Not that the advice wasn't sound, not that my friends didn't care, not that I still don't think she can be bossy and we still don't have fights, but Laura and I are together, and last time I checked, we plan to be for the rest of our lives. You see, there are things beyond prison. I would have known Laura anywhere. She just happened to come to me in handcuffs, smiling. She is the only person in the world who has met the sun to me. And I will spend the rest of my life being grateful and happy that she is out. Because so many similar stories don't end this way, I want to dedicate this one to anyone who's loved impossibly, to anyone who continues to love through death and disease and difference and distance and all the extravagant barriers that life, including prison, can put up. And to the women and men behind bars I know or have yet to know, please hang on. Love is as tangible as the body, you know, regardless of where our bodies are.
Seriously, folks.
Yeah, right. So the reason I was in handcuffs that day was because I kept going to the hall at DC jail because it was so horrible. The conditions were so horrible that we kept I kept fighting them and, you know, disobeying a direct order and this and that. So now we're going to talk about what happened next. And I guess the main thing I want to talk about here, there are two things. I mean, I already talked about the thing about HIV, and one thing I do want to say about HIV is that I'm always astounded. I don't know how it is here, and I know that there have been some wonderful prison groups here that sent us amazing stuff that was very useful when we were in prison. Passan, I don't know if it still exists. Yeah? Are you Passan? Are you Passan? Okay, I always hope I'll meet people. And anyway, but in the United States, none of the left groups that I know, now there's an AIDS movement. There's an AIDS movement that deals with international AIDS, and there are AIDS groups that deal in activist ways with HIV/AIDS in the United States. But given that, and it's probably true here too, there is such a thing also as AIDS apartheid, which is the line between the people who can afford medical care and get decent care and get individualized care instead of being given, okay, let's look at the guidelines, what's the first line therapy, that's what you take no matter what. Or the people who don't have health care at all or don't have access to care. And so the people who are living, pretty much, and the people who are dying. And the left, okay, and then there's the issue of HIV internationally, and the left in the United States, most organizations don't integrate that into their program. So, you know, you need, even if you're working on one issue, that's not your issue. If you're a left group with a global sort of program, or you say that you want revolution or you want fundamental change, then it seems to me that this epidemic, which it reflects so much the societies in which it takes place, whether that's, you know, gender inequality or whether it's homophobia and racism, and whether it's, as in the United States, the rates of HIV being much higher in prison, and particularly higher among women in prison, then that should be part of a program. So that's sort of been something that I have never figured out how to do anything about other than shrieking about it whenever I speak, so I just did, without really shrieking. The other thing, and this is the thing which I would be dedicated to wholly if not for the third thing I'm going to talk about, would be Palestine. And that's been a passion for me. I think probably a lot of Jews, someone was saying this last night, that a lot of Jews who are anti-Zionists, those of us who are anti-Zionists, are particularly shrill about the issue of that, because we feel it's sort of like being a citizen of the United States. You want to say this. There's something humiliating and infuriating about having someone who says they speak for you or represents you do such brutal, genocidal things. And so I think that's part of where my rage against Israel comes from. But I know that there's some really great divestiture and I can never remember the campaign as divestiture, boycott, and sanctions. Yeah. Groups up here, so I think that's great. So at this point in my life, especially given the massacre in Gaza, against Gaza, which Israel tried to call a war, I would be dedicating all of my time to that, but I have an issue that I can't get away from, and that's the issue of political prisoners. And I have said several times that the reason that I can't not do the political prisoner work and support political prisoners is that when you leave prison, you leave part of your heart inside, and that your divided heart makes you do it. But I realize that that's not really true for me, although that is true, but it's only partial true, because I've been doing political prisoner work since the 70s, since Geronimo Pratt. Do people know who that is? Okay, if you don't, please look it up, because he was a very clear victim of COINTELPRO. So first I want to say, for me, what's been important in the time that I was in prison about defining political prisoners is that internationally, and this is part of how the United States and other imperialist capitalist states try to put a lid on dissent, is that the only person who would be considered a political prisoner was someone who was either framed or a prisoner of conscience, someone who went to prison for refusing to do something or for saying something, who was put in prison for something they said or a stand they took. But internationally, and people here probably know this, anyone who is fighting as part of a national liberation struggle, fighting for justice, fighting for freedom, and from the left, from what we think of as the justice side of things, not a right wing group, is recognized as a political prisoner internationally. And so in the 60s and 70s, some of the black prisoners insisted on that they should be considered political prisoners because they had been caught in the course of fighting against the cops or taking a stand or a shootout or defending themselves. And so that is still a battle that we wage, and it's a very serious battle. I mean, what do you get? Maybe I'm preaching to the choir. I know there are a lot of prison groups here, and I do think that sometimes we think that the issue of political prisoners is separate or different from the issue of prisons in general. And I think that those prisons are sort of a whole thing, and there's repression against the general population, and that exists in the terms of just rounding up huge numbers of mostly youth of color and people of color and putting them in prison, and the genocide that results from, for example, from the number of women, black women of childbearing age in the United States who are locked up, and then where's the next generation going to come from, and who's going to nurture the next generation? On the one hand, so there's that mass repression that keeps people from being able to construct lives. And then if you lock up the political people, the most militant political people, then you take away the leadership of movements. And so it put the two things together, and you've got a nice, quiet, pro-capitalist situation. So I don't think that there's really a division. But for me, one of the things that I always got from supporting political prisoners and fighting for the release of political prisoners was, first of all, knowing some amazing people whose stories of survival and of remaining political in a situation where you're basically removed from your community and there are walls and bars and all kinds of things that separate you from your community and movement. So the ability of people to remain political activists and active and humane and human and not bitter and angry and nasty. So out of repression, they create resistance on all kinds of levels. So that's one thing. And the other thing is that, and I think for us in the United States, with all the confusion around, okay, Obama, so now is this democracy now? Are we a democracy yet? Is that if pushing on issues like political prisoners is a way of exposing the fact that there still is repression, massive repression in the Western capitalist countries. And so supporting one another's political prisoners is important. And I have to say, from the United States, we so need international support for the fact that there are political prisoners in the United States, and that people who are interested in the 60s, if we want to talk about the, you know, whatever it was, the nostalgia for the 60s. Well, there's something, you want to be part of the 60s, you can fight to free Herman Bell and Jalil Muntakim and Cindy Adekoli and the other prisoners who are in prison still from that time. So I wanted, I'm not going to talk about individuals because Susie's going to talk about Herman. And I think probably some people know about people. But I do want to talk about the San Francisco Eight for a minute, just in case people don't know about that. Because, the, you know, it's not just that we have to fight to free political prisoners because they've been in for 40 years, which some of them have. But also, the failure to get to win release for political prisoners means that the state is able to reinitiate old cases. So, you know, torture, Abu Ghraib, it was exposed. There was an, you know, international outcry against the United States. And while it was happening, the United States reinitiated a case that had been based on confessions from torture in the 1970s. A Black Panther case of a killing of a policeman in San Francisco. And they had indicted people back in the 70s, and it had been thrown out because the indictments, there was no evidence. The evidence was the confessions of people who were tortured for days in New Orleans. And now, you know, in the midst of the Bush era, the case has been reinstated. And you can read about it if you Google Free the SF8 dot whatever, org? Org, I think.
Org.
We're fighting, you know, even the police chief, the head of the police in New York State, when the arrests happened almost three years ago, said in a statement this should put to rest the legacy of the Black Panther Party, kind of once and for all. And I think that there's a war of ideas that's still going on about the 60s, and that part is not nostalgia. You know, that is the one part of it, you know, first of all, I should have said this when I was talking about, did I, about terrorism? No, I didn't. That there's, you know, a brainwash that has gone on for years about terrorism. Any, you bomb a building? Oh, you're a terrorist. No, terrorism is a specific form of struggle. It was used in Algeria. It's used sometimes against settler colonies. You target civilians in order to force a government to protect their civilians by withdrawing from your territory or by doing something you want. I don't particularly think that we have seen a single example of terrorism from any of the left armed groups. There has not been one. And so, you know, September 11th, that was terrorism. They, you know, they attacked civilians in the United States. No, even with the people who were killed were all cops or guards by the black forces. There have been a couple of accidental deaths in Francis Tavern in New York in the 70s. It was really unfortunate. A Puerto Rican busboy was killed in a bombing by the Fuerzas Armadas de Liberación Nacional, which was the Puerto Rican group. But there has never been a targeting. And it's really important, I think, to fight whenever you hear someone say, oh yeah, Bill Ayers, you know, terrorist, the Weather Underground, terrorist, Laura Whitehorn, terrorist. I don't, you can call me an idiot, or you can call me a fucking idiot if you want, but sorry, in group joke. And or you can, whatever, but do not ever call me a terrorist, because I'm not, I will admit, I did those bombings. I've never, at once we, you know, even when we were on trial, before trial, I never said I'm innocent. We never said that. We said, who's more violent, us or the U.S. government? You know, we said things like that. I've never denied that I did them. I was luckily, I mean, I was never interviewed by the FBI. I refused to talk to them. So I just really want to be clear about that, because what we've seen in the United States with the anti-abortion people, when they adopted right to life and they made us all say, okay, right to choose, you know, which, whatever, we were on the defensive immediately. And so that use of language is really important. And so when you hear the political prisoners called criminals or terrorists, that is really important, I think, to to oppose. So one last thing on political prisoners is that we have, like in the United States now, you know, a new president and all that, and I would imagine that people here are fairly sophisticated to know that the Democratic Party is not a socialist party, and that Obama is not a socialist president, and that we still, in fact, he's been a vast disappointment on any topic that you can think of. But the thing that's true is that we're rid of Bush and Cheney, and that is important. And so we have a chance now to sort of activate people and sort of say, okay, it's up to us to recreate justice. And fighting for release of the political prisoners, fighting that they be allowed to be released on parole, which they have a right to. Fighting to say, only in the United States is a life sentence mean that you go home in a box. You know, in Europe, and I don't know what a life sentence is here, but in Europe, a life sentence is, what, 20, 25 years? All the people from the Red Army faction.
Well, actually, Carl from Kurspilepadep says there's two left. But basically, a life sentence is your productive year. So you get into your 50s, 60s, and they consider your life is basically
over. Right.
So they let you out.
They've taken it. So I'm going to turn it over now to Susie, because part of my issue about political prisoners is that it's something that people can care about. And she's an example, because she wasn't someone who was supporting political prisoners when she came to meet us. And it's true, not everyone has to fall in love with a fucking political prisoner in order to... But she saw something in us, in the fact that we believed in freedom. We wanted freedom so badly. We wanted justice. And that we saw our freedom and our justice tied up with that of other people, that we didn't really have the same fears of going to prison. And I still say, and it was, for me, it was only 14 years, which is not very long compared to most political prisoners, but it was so worth it, because to be able to look back at my life and say, I did what I wanted to do. And I did it. I thought it was right. I still do. I mean, we can talk about strategy and tactics, and I think there are a lot of things to talk about using violence. It's a really dangerous thing to do, and you have to really remember your revolutionary principles at all times and see that if there's a target that you can't, you know, safely attack, or if you don't need to use that tactic, that you shouldn't. But it's good to know that we can build a movement where we know that we're going to fight for freedom, and that longing is in our bones for justice, and that we will do it even if it costs us something. So take it away, Susie Day.
What she said. There's just so much there, and I can't possibly respond to all of it. I do want to go back to the Palestine-Israel huge debacle, and say that, you know, as I don't know if the other goyim in the room feel this, but I think I have a much harder time decrying Israel than Lara does, or probably a lot of Jewish activists do. And I guess I want to be upfront about, you know, my emotional fear of being called anti-Semitic, Holocaust denier, you know, all that stuff. It's horribly painful, and it's one of the most painful topics in the world. And I think, you know, that's one thing that I guess I would want to bring to a later discussion of this. You know, it's like it's not easy. It's not easy saying, maybe for some people it is. It's not easy for me, although I...
do it enough.
I show up at demos but we live actually on the either side of Orthodox Jews in our building, and our keffiyehs are sort of kept under our coats when we go out. So, you know, it's a very complex, human, complicated and painful thing, especially in New York. So anyway, political prisoners, yes. I still am involved with political prisoners in terms of friendships. We just visited David Gilbert on the way up here.
Yeah, yay, David.
Yeah.
Yay, David.
Who is responsible for the fucking idiot line, actually. Because David never says anything like that, and he said
that. And Herman Bell is one of our close friends. I wrote this a long time ago before Herman got taken away to the West Coast for the San Francisco 8 case, where he has been inside bars for going on 3 years now. They have not let them outside. So anyway, people are really suffering out there. And speaking of suffering, this is a story about our visiting Herman when he was still in the Eastern Penitentiary.
But give the context of yes. how you wrote this, or do you want me to?
Okay.
So Herman was coming up for parole, and I'm gonna because she has to because she doesn't.
Yeah, Herman was coming up for parole, and
the
only coverage he got in the mainstream was this is a killer. This is this is one of these animals who belongs behind bars for the rest of their lives, and that's exactly the kind of terminology they were using, and a lot of the left media wouldn't touch it for various reasons, or they were just too busy, or. And so I decided to write this just from our perspective of having gone to see Herman once. We'd gone before, we've known him for years, but this is just one visit. It could be worse, I say to myself as I buy my Trailways ticket. He could be on death row. He could be dying in a prison infirmary. He could be getting beaten up by racist gangs. Instead, Herman Bell is doing 25 years to life at a prison outside New York City where we can take the bus to visit him and make sure he's okay. It's Herman's birthday today, and my girlfriend Lara and I are meeting our friends and their baby who've driven here from Montreal to New York State's Eastern Correctional Facility. I suppose I should get the demographics out of the way. The baby is approaching the terrible age of 2. All of us are white. And we're going to visit our friend who, like a disproportionate number of his fellow prisoners, is black. The five of us enter the huge gray building, which manages to look both looming and funky, a satanic version of Harry Potter's Hogwarts. We go through the usual inanities of emptying pockets and taking off jackets, shoes, earrings to get them through the metal detector. The baby, who looks like she could be packing a rod, is also searched. When the guards decide we are non-terrorists, they stamp our hands and unbolt the door to the visiting room. Inside, there's the usual fluorescent-lit din, dozens of parents and friends and wives and girlfriends sitting in plastic chairs at formica tables with men in dark green prison suits trying to make each moment count as little kids yell and race each other through the vending machines. We find a table, buy bad coffee, and in comes Herman, a tall, sweetly smiling, quiet man, coach of the prison's football team, who leans down to hug us one by one. Herman is 58 years old today. He has spent the last 33 years in prison. Good, scream headlines in New York City papers. Don't let this killer walk. Keep Bell on ice. In front of news cameras, Patrick Lynch, president of the Patrolman's Benevolent Association, declares, these cold-blooded assassins and domestic terrorists should remain in jail for the rest of their lives. A model prisoner, Herman has maybe one chance in 20 of getting out when he comes up for parole again next month. The PBA wants to reduce that chance to nothing. In 1973, when he was in the Black Panther Party, Herman was arrested and charged with Panthers Anthony Jaleel Bonham and Albert Noah Washington in the 1971 shooting deaths of two New York City police officers, Joseph Piacentini and Waverly Jones. According to media accounts, Piacentini and Jones were responding to a domestic abuse complaint when they were killed on the streets of Harlem. Diane Piacentini, Joseph's widow, appears on TV with Lynch to urge that Herman be denied parole from now until the end of time. They flash an ugly mugshot of Herman in his Panther days, nostrils flared, eyes fierce, and a get whitey scowl, a monster. Here at the correctional facility, the monster cuddles the squirming baby, then lets her down to play. I watch Lara touch Herman's arm and ask him how he's doing. Coming here is hard for Lara, who's done over 14 years in prison herself on political charges. After your arrest, the cops spend time harassing you and knocking you around, she told me once. Then they take your picture looking all miserable and mean to scare people. Herman and his co-defendants argued in court they weren't guilty, that the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover's COINTELPRO, which called the Panthers America's number one threat, cooked the evidence. The first trial ended in a hung jury. The second resulted in life sentences for the defendants and a book contract for the district attorney. Understand there was a war going on between police and the community, says Lara, who spent years in the Weather Underground supporting the Panthers. I roll my eyes and wonder if there is ever not a war going on when needless deaths like this happen. Yet after Herman's conviction, an ex-Panther witness came forth to say that his testimony against Herman was the result of police torture. I cannot judge Diane Piacentini. I don't know if I'd be able to stop hating in her place. And yet, someone has. Miraculously, someone has. Waverly Jones Jr., son of the other slain officer, has come to New York twice now with some of his family to ask the parole board to let Herman out. Jones, a baby when his father was killed, stated, "Nothing would give me more pleasure or joy than to see that man walk out of prison doors." This is a stunning, almost unprecedented thing. But given a national zeitgeist that allows people condemned to death in the face of pleas from the likes of Desmond Tutu and the Pope to be duly executed, it isn't big news. So we don't talk about this with Herman. We barely talk about parole. Here in the visiting room, we've started a little birthday party, pouring water into plastic bottle caps. We toast one another with pinkies extended and gossip. Herman, with a plastic spoon, cuts an awful Reese's peanut butter cake, and we sing happy birthday. Herman wants to hear about Lars and my cat, Rhoda, whose mission is to shed orange fur globally. Our friends talk about working in the Victory Garden that Herman organized from prison, which used to distribute vegetables to inner cities. Herman chuckles at how bad the football team he's coaching is, but he's excited about his new granddaughter. He remembers back when he was in Mississippi, a sharecropper's kid, catching fish on the banks of a river after a rain. He seems like a kid again when he says, "We just had so much fun." Although his face looks suddenly crinky and puzzled at the other memories that arrive. The baby is now intently exploring her overalls with another two-year-old, and I wonder what's been done to Herman in here, how he gets through, as he's called it, one more day on the plantation. But surviving evil doesn't make you a good person. Surviving evil and not passing it on does. I've visited Herman for years, and I would trust this good man with my life. Herman has actually saved lives in here, but they've just announced visiting hours are over, and we gather up the baby, who is not even a little tired. We turn to go, and Herman admires the beat-up leather jacket I've pulled on. I say, "Yeah, Lara got it for me. $16, streets of New York." Herman smiles. "Would you help me pick out one like that when I get out?" What? What did he say? When I get out? Did you forget how they hate you, Herman? Am I supposed to say, "Be reasonable, go back to your cell now. Go back to be strip searched and monitored and controlled, and don't worry, Herman, we'll see you when we can, you know. There may be times when they won't let us in, but we'll keep trying to reach you through the vengeance and fear. We'll all grow old together, and we'll always hope. Is that what I should tell you, my dear friend, my brother?" I look up at him, and I say, "Yes, God damn yes. With all my heart, I would love to help you pick out that jacket, Herman. It would be an honor."